Annie Rourke Rubenstein sat with the 12 Navy SEALs in the aft section of the Nazi gunship. Like her, they were all dressed in SS field uniforms, all armed with Nazi weapons, their own weapons concealed beneath their uniforms, as were her own weapons. Several of the SEAL team personnel were putting last-minute touch-ups to the edges of their fighting knives, these as widely divergent as she could imagine. Some carried knives roughly shaped like her father's Crane LSX, only smaller. Others carried double-edged daggers. She missed her father, just thinking of him. If they succeeded in bringing him back from the brink of death, she would tell him how much she loved him. And if her father survived, she had already decided that she would be as understanding as humanly possible when the time came for her father and mother to separate. Her mother, if the woman she had spoken with, hugged, was indeed her mother, would never forgive her father for something her father had not done, thanks to Dietrich Zimmer's brainwashing techniques, which were beyond measure in their effectiveness. In an odd way, Dietrich Zimmer had solved a problem which had been in evidence since before the night of the war. Parents often thought that their children were at once deaf, dumb, and blind, that their children didn't notice the friction building between father and mother, husband and wife. From her earliest days, she had realized that mommy and dad did not get along, that there was something wrong between them. By the time she was old enough to know what it was, they were into the survival situation, the framework of which they had lived with in all of her adult life. And there was nothing to be done about it. She had seen the way Natalia loved her father, and her father loved Natalia, and her father had intentionally engineered a situation in which Natalia would become Michael's wife rather than his own. Even though his plans had not worked the way he had intended, eventually Natalia and Michael were thrown together and became lovers. Soon, when all of this was over, and there was at least a moment left to them in which to be normal, whatever that was, Natalia and Michael would be married. But her father, had he not met Emma Shaw, would still have been alone. Once it became clear that Wolfgang Mann and her mother, Sarah Rourke, loved each other, her father could have done nothing else but step aside. Fortunately for him, there was Emma Shaw to go to. If her father did not survive, Annie would always be a friend to Emma Shaw, always treat her with the love and respect that she would have shown had her father married her. Emma Shaw's mind was always able to function on two different levels, and she imagined that everyone else's mind was able to do the same. With one portion of her consciousness, she checked and double-checked the control panel. On another level, however, she reviewed other matters of importance. She refused to consider that John Rourke would die, and she would become a widow before she had become a bride. She would never marry should he die, because there could be no other man who would be anything like him. Instead, Emma Shaw considered what her life would be like if John Rourke lived. Technically, she would be Annie and Michael's stepmother, Paul's, and eventually Natalia's, stepmother-in-law.
Weird.
But what about Sarah Rourke? Was it the real Sarah Rourke who believed those awful lies about John? What would things be like with her? Emma Shaw knew that she was the other woman, the evil seductress, hard to imagine herself seducing anyone, who had led the faithful husband astray. On one level, she felt it was about time, but on another level, she felt guilty. But John deserved a life, and so did she. John deserved someone to come home to who would not constantly rail at him for who he was and what he was, but love him as he was. When the war ended, she would retire, leave the Navy if John lived, devote her full time to being wife, and she felt her cheeks flushing for the first time since she didn't know when. Mother? Would John get her pregnant? Would she bear his children? What would they be like? She'd given up on the idea of motherhood years ago, but her biological clock was running just great, and she could do it.
Do you think I'd make a good mother?
Do you think I would?
Yeah, an interesting mother, but a good one.
I'd say the same about you. Are we checked out?
Yeah. Make certain that all seat restraints are secure. This will be a bumpy ride once we're over the Himalayas. All you SEAL team guys, put away any sharp objects, huh? Hang on and pray.
Pray?
That we get this done and we get out with our skins. Yeah, pray. Okay?
All right.
Michael Rourke made a last-minute check of the two Beretta 92Fs under his SS officer's field tunic.
We're cleared by control. We're going in.
Ahead of them, Michael Rourke saw a granite doorway sliding away and a gleaming, red-lit hole appear within the face of the mountain before them. This was it, and his father's life depended upon the outcome, and perhaps also his mother's sanity. If the woman purporting to be Sarah Rourke really was Sarah Rourke and not her clone, the only person who would have a prayer of convincing her that the memories she recalled so vividly were implanted rather than real would be his father. And the chance for success was slight.
I understand that Jason Darkwood played it a lot by the seat of the pants.
He did indeed, James. He was an interesting man. I seriously doubt he did anything by the book in his life. That was why Jason Darkwood and Sebastian made such an interesting pair. Sebastian was his direct opposite in Jason Darkwood's. Sebastian researched every detail, whereas Jason Darkwood just sort of winged it as he went along. Now, in some men, that's brilliance. It was that way with Jason Darkwood. John has often said that Jason Darkwood was possibly the most talented tactician he'd ever met. All tactics is advanced problem solving. You couple that with innovation, you have the brilliance I mentioned. He had that, Jason Darkwood.
He's been a tough act to live up to.
No one could accuse the three of us with tactical brilliance with this plan. God help us, because that's the only way we're going to even come close to pulling it off.
May he help us indeed.
Paul started their stolen Nazi gunship into the tunnel mouth. The door to the takeoff and landing bay was about 100 feet high and three times that across. James Darkwood's eyes followed the door as it closed. Someone would have to get to the controls for the escape and make certain that the doorway stayed open until they were through. The landing bay generally followed the largely guesswork diagram which Emma Shaw had originated via Darkwood Naval Air Station's computer. So far, so good. The takeoff and landing bay was cut from the natural rock. The ceiling, uneven, piping, conduit, even a passenger and freight monorail moving across it from side to side, emerging from far smaller cuts in the living rock, perhaps passing from one takeoff and landing bay to another. They would have to investigate that. The technique for the cutting of the chamber was something which would have been unknown in the days of the Rourke family's past. The enormous retreats of the old mountain civilizations had been blasted and hacked into existence, originating around natural caves and fissures. This would have been lasered from the living rock, much faster, much more precisely, and almost certainly more economically. Darkwood stepped down from the gunship's portside fuselage door and onto the tarmac, straightening his uniform blouse beneath the Arctic parka as he did so, careful not to dislodge his weapons. For compatibility with Paul Rubenstein and Michael Rourke, he left behind his familiar .45 automatic and opted instead for borrowing two 9mm Parabellum Lancer reproduction Sig Sauer P226s from Darkwood Naval Air Station's armory. The SIGs were carried by high-altitude observation pilots as part of their personal defense weapons package. He had no chest holster for either of the two guns, so they were tucked into his waistband. Paul Rubenstein and Michael Rourke emerged from the gunship, taking up positions slightly to his rear in their roles as junior officers. An armed SS detachment, an officer and four men carrying assault rifles, approached them where they stood. The officer, only an Untersturmführer, analogous to an ensign in the Navy or second lieutenant in the Marine Corps, stopped several paces away from them and saluted.
Oh, good afternoon, Herr Obersturmbannführer. On behalf of Herr Dr. Dietrich Zimmer, allow me to welcome you and the other officers to the facility. I am Untersturmführer Wilhelm Lietz, at your service.
Ein Obersturmbannführer, Rudolf Gessler. Allow me to introduce Sturmbannführer Leibnitz and Hauptsturmführer Gerber. As you no doubt are aware, Untersturmführer Lietz, these officers and myself have undergone quite an ordeal. We must, as quickly as possible, be debriefed, but I fear we first require the opportunity to,
Darkwood gestured across his uniform. The trousers were wrinkled, the boots no longer gleamed. He rubbed his left hand down along his cheeks to his chin, a universal symbol for needing a shave.
I quite understand, Herr Obersturmbannführer. Such preparations have already been made. A formality first, however, Herr Obersturmbannführer.
Untersturmführer Leitz held out his right hand, gloved palm up.
But of course.
Darkwood responded, producing his papers from beneath his tunic, holding out his left hand palm upward for Paul Rubenstein's and Michael Rourke's papers. He passed all three sets over to Untersturmführer Leitz.
I shall return these as quickly as it has been established that they are in order, Herr Obersturmbannführer.
Very good, Untersturmführer. And now we wish to refresh ourselves.
But of course, sir.
The Untersturmführer fell in beside and a half pace behind Darkwood, directing him as they walked along the portion of the takeoff and landing bay's enormous length toward a caged elevator. The makeup Darkwood wore in order to match the appearance of the man in the papers whom he was replacing was a little itchy. The reference he had made to shaving was indeed becoming necessary, but his beard under the makeup was the problem, and one which could not be remedied. Paul Rubinstein followed James Darkwood out of the elevator into a small corridor. The corridor, nothing more than a guard station and two parallel banks of elevators. Beyond and to the left were tunnels, stations situated there for accessing the monorails. Paul's German was not very good, but he could follow along generally with the sporadic shots of conversation exchanged between Darkwood and the young Nazi officer who was their guide. The four stormtroopers accompanying them, with assault rifles held at port arms, were what really worried him. If his identity were discovered, he would be dead, or else soon be wishing that he were. Among the SS, as he had heard through intelligence sources, he was considerably talked about. It was rumored that somehow, single-handedly, his survival after the night of the war had reintroduced Jews into the world population. And although these days the Nazis had more pressing interests, their lack of fondness for Jews had not diminished. They would never take him alive if he could help it, and he would take as many of them as he could with him. Killing Nazis was, after all, a service to humanity. Paul forced himself to relax a little, to stop fantasizing about drugstore stands against hordes of SS men bent on his destruction. There was the matter of kidnapping the clone who would become the donor of a new heart for his progenitor, John Rourke. The matter of killing a living human being in order to make the heart available was a difficult one. And he had determined that as much as the thought of cold-blooded murder repelled him, he was the one who should do it. He'd live with what guilt there would be. Better by far than living with the thought of his best friend's death on his conscience or inflicting the murder of the clone on someone else. That was the sort of guilt he couldn't endure. Their guide, Lights, waved them past the guard station into another bank of elevators. Paul kept his hands as close as he could to the pistols beneath his tunic, just in case. Officers in the Nazi army rarely carried anything but a pistol, so he had no assault rifle. The Nazi pistol at his belt would be the first thing looked for if a trap lay in store for them. They entered an elevator, the four guards taking a second car.
There will not be a better chance.
Untersturmfuhrer Light started to turn around. The corridor was empty. This was clearly a residential section to which the car had brought them.
Guards are 15 seconds behind us.
Darkwood's hands were busy screwing a suppressor onto the muzzle of one of the Sig Sauer 226s. The second elevator came to a stop.
Hello, gentlemen.
They'll be wise to us the second somebody looks into this elevator car. We could leave the body somewhere else, but the bloodstains would betray what happened anyway.
Agreed.
James Darkwood was holding the second elevator car for them.
Back downstairs. I caught what level it was where we entered. Best shot at finding the area where they keep the clones.
In about 10 minutes, the others should be arriving. We'll have to keep these bodies out of sight until then.
I'll stay with them. I'm the logical choice since my German's next best. Meet you guys when the shooting starts. Be careful.
Michael was taking the greatest danger onto himself because he would have to babysit the dead men until the second chopper arrived, assuming it was allowed to land. Michael passed back their identity papers, presumably taken from the dead Untersturmfuhrer's body.
Agreed.
What choice do we have?
Paul grabbed two of the assault rifles, one for himself and one for Darkwood. As made sense, the rifles were energy weapons, considering the enclosed area in which the guards worked. But they would have to do. Michael switched on the first elevator car, looking down at the five dead Nazis.
We're all going for a ride, guys. Now, no talking, huh?
He shot a wave toward Paul and James Darkwood as the doors closed.
Shit!
Paul entered the second car and James Darkwood worked the elevator buttons, already starting to fix a suppressor to his second pistol. Paul, in addition to his high powers, had borrowed Natalia's suppressor-fitted Walther PPKS. The suppressor was recently refitted with current state-of-the-art baffles, which, unlike the original suppressors, never needed replacement or cleaning. The decibel rating was such that the most noise came from the operation of the slide, she'd told him. He was, evidently, going to get the opportunity for a grueling field test of it. The energy rifles were both slung to Paul's right shoulder. How he would explain them to anyone was another matter, but if anyone started to seriously question them, that person would have to be silenced at any event. In the final analysis, the presence of the energy weapons really didn't matter. James Darkwood stepped from the elevator, Paul Rubinstein beside him. The guard on duty there looked up at them.
We are personal agents of Herr Dr. Zimmer. You must obey my instructions to the letter, Rottenführer. If you value the future of the Reich in your own life.
Yes, Herr Obersturmbannführer.
There is a plot against our Führer's life, Various Allied agents have infiltrated themselves into this complex for the express purpose of assassinating Dietrich Zimmer, even at the cost of their own lives. They could only have succeeded in reaching this facility and penetrating it successfully, as they have already done, with the cooperation of certain key officers within the staff here. We alone know the identity of the leader of this group of saboteurs. Tell me, Rattenführer, as you undoubtedly have a great familiarity with the facility, what is the most expeditious route to the laboratory where Dr. Zimmer performs his biological experiments? But a route which would be least subject to scrutiny for a team of armed men.
The monorail would be the best way, Herr Obersturmbannführer.
The controls for the monorail system are?
Each car is independently controlled, Herr Obersturmbannführer, and can take the appropriate siding.
Which siding would these men exit from so they would be nearest to the laboratory facilities?
Siding 14.
Is there anything else for which we should be made aware, Rattenführer? Remember, your name will figure heavily into my personal report to the Führer. Think, man.
There are always two guards posted at each laboratory doors. It would be impossible for such men as you to describe to pass these guards. I have been assigned to that post many times, and the standing orders are to shoot to kill anyone who is not recognizable as a member of the laboratory staff, Herr Obersturmbannführer.
Yes, one would think such precautions would be adequate, but they are not. Some of the conspirators are, in fact, involved in Herr Dr. Zimmer's laboratory experiments, Rattenführer.
Darkwood started walking the corporal toward the monorail station, over his shoulder noticing that Paul Rubinstein was in a perfect position to command fire over both elevator banks and the service elevator from the takeoff and landing bay below them. While Darkwood had this cooperative young man at his disposal, he wanted to verify the monorail controls and make certain that he could operate the gondola.
You must remain vigilant here and refuse to be taken in by contradictory orders, Rattenführer. That is clear?
Ja, Herr Obersturmbannführer.
Overlooking the gondola controls and satisfied that the machine was powered up and could be used, Darkwood slipped one of the suppressor-fitted 9mm pistols from beneath his tunic.
Come on!
Already, Paul Rubinstein was running toward the gondola. Together, they hauled the dead man into the gondola with them, pulling down the gull-wing-style canopy opening. The gondola automatically powered up. Darkwood sat at the control panel.
Station 14 it is.
Paul Rubinstein was already going through the dead man's pockets for anything useful. Maps, papers, general orders. The monorail gondola glided away from the station. They came out of a small tunnel, passing through free space. Below them, the true vastness of the takeoff and landing bays could be seen. Darkwood judged that the one through which they had entered the complex was the furthest west of the three. This, the center one. What he saw before him on the control panel only served to confirm that. There was an illuminated diagram, or map, set into the control panel, the panel itself merely consisting of energy controls, the operation of the gondola entirely automated, it seemed, once the destination station was entered into the memory. Station 14 was beyond the third bay. A lighted diode moved along the representation on the control panel, showing their position relative to the monorail route. The gondola entered a small tunnel, traveling past a station identical to the one at which they had boarded, then, leaving the tunnel, passed over the third takeoff and landing bay. As in the one through which they had entered the facility and the one over which they had just passed, there were more V-Stall fighter aircraft here than James Darkwood had adequate time to count.
Oof, about 100 planes or so.
Yeah, more or less. And we've got to figure a way to keep them from getting airborne after us.
I think I know what we'll have to do. We can't sabotage all the aircrafts themselves. We'll have to destroy the opening and closing mechanism for the doors. The doors themselves will be bomb-proof, and there should be emergency controls away from the main control station. Unless these people are imbeciles. And I wouldn't count on that.
Neither would I. So you mean we destroy the actual mechanism for opening and closing?
Exactly. I watched how they run. It looks like it'll be a series of levers, and the levers are exposed on the interior side of the doors. If we can sabotage just one of the joints, the doors will be jammed shut until repair parts can be brought in. That should give us enough time to get out of here.
What about the takeoff and landing bay we use for our escape? Think we can screw with the aircraft in there?
I don't know. We'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it and see what Natalie and Annie and Emma Shaw and the SEAL team guys are able to do before we get there. We'll have plenty of explosives, but not plenty of time to use them.
Darkwood's eyes followed their course on the control panel map. The gondola was nearly at Station 14. 3 minutes remained before the second gunship would be requesting permission to land over the Nazi distress frequency. When Paul Rubinstein had begun landing the gunship he'd flown here, carrying Michael and James Darkwood as his only passengers, he had advised the tower that a second ship carrying injured survivors of the battle for the headquarters complex in Canada was close behind them and should be admitted. If the dead bodies he, Michael, and James Darkwood had left behind them so far weren't discovered, there was a very good chance that Natalia or Emma should be able to land, and the second and most important phase of the plan, to their own survival at least, would be underway. Natalia suppressed Walter PPKS in his right hand, behind his back. Paul Rubinstein exited the monorail gondola after James Darkwood at Station 14. Beyond the confines of the station itself lay a guard post and elevator banks similar to those where they had boarded the gondola. There was a Sturmmann on duty here, a little older looking despite his one grade lower rank than the Rotenführer who had proven so helpful to them. This man would have to die as well.
Tell me if you have seen any armed men passing this way.
I have seen none, Herr Obersturmbannführer. Papers, please. Access to unauthorized personnel is restricted beyond this point.
The man's weapon was held at high port.
Certainly, Strumman.
Darkwood began fishing in his uniform tunic, and Paul Rubinstein's eyes drifted to the passive alarm visible on the guard's right wrist. Passive alarms were sensible devices, cued to the wearer's body orientation and pulse rate. Any radical change in either, such as might be precipitated by a sudden fall, would trigger the alarm. The person wearing the alarm had 15 seconds to deactivate it before the alarm was broadcast into the receiving net. Paul Rubinstein did not know if Darkwood had noticed it or not. There would be a code which had to be punched into the alarm in order to prevent its being broadcast. Without the code, the alarm could not be neutralized. There was only one way around the system. Paul took it, walking up to the guard very quickly and sticking the muzzle of the suppressor to the man's temple.
Move and I'll kill you! Cooperate and you have my word I will not! What'll it be?
Darkwood's pistols were out as well, pointed at the guard. The guard's tough demeanor vanished. Darkwood snatched away his rifle.
We have to get him slowly to the floor, then tie him so securely that he can't activate the alarm. He can't be killed either.
Shit. All right.
Darkwood pulled off his foraging cap, secreted within the turned-up ear flaps, the modern equivalent of plastic flex cuffs. Darkwood moved the Nazi guard's wrists slowly around behind the man, then bound them together. Once this was accomplished, Paul, still holding the pistol to the man's head, Darkwood similarly bound the fellow's ankles. If someone arrived at the monorail station, a shooting war would begin on the spot, but there was nothing else to do, and no more rapid pace could be trusted to succeed. Darkwood reached into the pocket of his parka and produced a syringe kit.
This injection will not kill you, merely put you to sleep. I promise that the needle is clean. This won't slow his pulse too much.
It shouldn't, unless he has a reaction to the drug.
Together, they caught up the fellow's body, lowering him slowly, gently, into a reclining position. Then carrying him into the sentry station, resting him on the floor within the enclosure, out of sight unless someone looked into the enclosure.
He'll be missed.
In another few minutes, there'll probably be an alert anyway.
Is everybody ready?
Armed personnel were moving toward the gunship as it touched down on the pad on the far side of the takeoff and landing bay. Emma Shaw could see the first gunship, recognizing on the fuselage the serialization which she had memorized. It was good luck that they had been allowed to land in the same bay. Medical personnel were standing by some distance away from the pad, so at least the story that there were wounded Nazi commandos aboard the gunship was partially believed.
Make every shot count. There are vastly more of them than there are of us. We need to be clear of the helicopter before the shooting starts in earnest. Don't forget.
Then Natalia turned to Emma as they unbuckled their seat restraints.
Stay close to me. Annie will be with me too. This isn't your usual kind of fighting. Remember, the idea is to put someone down. You're good with a gun. Don't get frightened by what's going on around you. Keep your purpose in mind. Remember, the three of us will stay together.
I understand.
Ready to use your guns, then.
Natalia started aft, Emma at her heels. Annie already standing beside the fuselage door, a Nazi assault rifle at high port. Like Natalia's and her own, Annie's hair, considerably longer than theirs, was stuffed under a black SS foraging cap. Half of the men from the SEAL team would exit the gunship first, Emma and the other two women mixing in between these men and the other six.
It should take all of 45 seconds for us to get some distance between ourselves and the aircraft. But for those 45 seconds, it is important that we are the most arrogant and convincing SS commandos we can be. Remember, 45 seconds. Critical. Critical.
The lock mechanism of the portside fuselage door was released and the door was opened. A dozen SS commandos, reinforced by six men wearing the insignia of SS Luftwaffe Police, waited for them, guns at high port. They were all energy rifles. Six SEAL team members step down onto the tarmac, their assault rifles, Nazi, slung in such a manner that using them would hopefully appear to be the last thing on any of their minds. Three of the men had theatrical blood on their faces, and one of the men wore his left arm in a sling and was helped by another. Within the sling, he carried a pistol for his right hand and a knife for his left. She'd seen him checking the weapons in the instant before the door was slid open. Annie, Natalia, and Emma Shaw jumped down, two more SEAL team men flanking them, the last four behind them. The leader of the guard detail, a Hauptsturmführer with a nasty look in his bright blue eyes, was arguing with Lieutenant Christakos, the SEAL team leader, wearing Hauptsturmführer's rank as well. Natalia, also wearing officer's rank, started away from the gunship edging, some of the men around her along with her. Two of the guards, enlisted men, moved to block Natalia's path. Natalia's right hand moved ever so subtly. Suddenly, quiet action exploded all around Emma. The men who had greeted them at the gunship were all dead on the tarmac. Their grace period would only last for a few seconds longer, Emma Shaw realized, but the further they got away from the gunship and the closer to the control center, the better their chance. Natalia strode purposefully ahead.
Let's go!
Annie swung her rifle into a hard assault position, spraying it into a knot of SS personnel beside the metal steps leading up into the control center. Emma saw Natalia, out of the left corner of her peripheral vision, running for the control center steps. Christakos and two other SEAL team members with her. And Emma Shaw remembered Natalia's admonition. She tapped Annie Rubenstein on the shoulder, and the two of them started after Natalia. Natalia was halfway up the steps, a pistol in each hand. Two men wearing Luftwaffe insignia, energy rifles in their hands, appeared in the doorway. Natalia tore the cap from her head, shaking loose her hair.
Lieutenant Christakos, get three of your men to hold this control center. Get the door open immediately before they kill power or we'll never get out. And get the explosives set. Let's go!
And Natalia was running down the steps, Annie right behind her, Emma Shaw at their heels. Paul Rubenstein shook his head to clear it as he followed James Darkwood at a steady, controlled pace toward the two armed guards flanking the doors leading into the laboratory.
No sense in pretending anymore.
Darkwood, keeping low, reached across to the door handle, gave it a twist, and pushed. Paul Rubenstein went through first. There were about a dozen technicians standing at work tables, dazed looks on their faces, the alarm sounding still, all eyes on the muzzle of Paul Rubenstein's rifle. As Paul was about to order them to raise their hands, Dietrich Zimmer and Martin Zimmer stepped from their midst.
Holy shit.
Paul Rubenstein was on one knee, the assault rifle to his shoulder, the Walter in his belt. Across the sights of the rifle, he stared at Dietrich Zimmer.
We want one of the clones. Give us a clone of John Rourke and you might get out of here alive.
You will both die. As to the commando operation going on in Aircraft Bay 1, the personnel involved are as good as dead. Surrender your weapons now.
Eat me.
Paul Rubenstein slowly stood, the rifle still to his shoulder, the sight still on Dietrich Zimmer's chest.
You'll be dead too, Doctor. I came for one of John Rourke's clones. Take us to where you keep them.
You do not realize, do you? I am a clone.
Zimmer drew a pistol from the pocket of his lab coat. Paul Rubenstein pulled the trigger. The sirens sounding throughout the complex were almost a relief because Michael Rourke was becoming physically ill from riding up and down in the elevator car with the five dead bodies. The proximity to the late SS men was not what bothered him. Although he had never been motion sick in his life, he was feeling motion sick now. Men raced past him along the corridor, but no one seemed to pay attention to him. He used a knuckle on his left hand to hit a floor button, the top floor, and stepped through the doors as they began to close. The explosives belted around Michael Rourke's waist were the next order of business. Elevators were opening, disgorging armed men into the corridor, and Michael had a flash of inspiration. He stepped into the first open elevator, let the door close, the car empty except for himself. As the car started up, Michael opened the panel and took manual control, stalling the elevator at the next highest level. He removed one of the explosive charges from his belt, peeled away the backing, and clamped it to the panel. It was treated with self-stick adhesive. He set the timer for 60 seconds, reactivated the floor controls to bring him down, stepped through, and at the same time hit the switch and pushed the button for the top floor. There was another empty elevator going up just across the corridor from him. Bullying his way through a knot of enlisted SS personnel, he entered the empty elevator, let the doors close, then repeated the process he had carried out in the first car. The explosives were powerful enough that they would destroy all the elevators on each side once they detonated. Mentally ticking off the seconds, he set this charge at 45 seconds, so it would detonate 15 seconds after the first one. He returned to the level where the landing bays were accessed and left the elevator, activating the explosive charge and hitting the top floor button at the same time. He wore four more explosive charges and was determined to put them to good use, walking as quickly as he could to the monorail station. After a few seconds, an empty car came, returning from depositing men summoned from the other landing bays. The first explosion came from the elevator banks. There was always the slight possibility that he might be causing the deaths of his friends by sabotaging the elevators and the monorail gondolas, but it was standard operating procedure in something like this to avoid any such mechanical means of traveling from one area to another because of the risk of being stuck between floors, or in this case, between stations. Paul and James Darkwood would likely adhere to the dictum, he hoped. Alone in the car, he programmed for the next station, set an explosive charge, and when he reached the next station, left, activating the charge. He felt the second detonation in the elevator banks. He would have to go down to the takeoff and landing bay below him on foot or use the elevator cage. He opted for the former, then somehow find a way into the first landing bay. There would be mechanical access ports, he was certain, and he had three more charges to use up. So far, so good. Martin Zimmer was a clone too, of course. Paul Rubinstein realized when he had been suckered. Darkwood held all the lab technicians at bay against the far wall, and Paul Rubinstein, with the clone of Martin Zimmer in tow, stood before the vault door leading into the chambers beyond where the clones were kept. And he made a bet with himself. That this Martin Zimmer, if a clone, was truly identical once the mind of the original was downloaded into its brain, would be just as cowardly as the original. Paul shoved the muzzle of the suppressor on Natalia's Walther against Martin Zimmer's clone's nose.
Do you want to die?
There was no answer except in the eyes. Paul glanced at the locking mechanism for the vault door.
Will your handprint operate the lock?
Only Dietrich Zimmer's handprint will do that. And he is not here. You lose.
I don't think so. You know who I am? I'm the Jew, Rubinstein. And I'm gonna find it especially nice to leave you alive if you cooperate so you can tell everyone how Dietrich Zimmer screwed himself.
What do you mean?
A clone is physically identical to the original, right?
Yes, but...
Even if Dietrich Zimmer isn't here, his hand is.
Lieutenant Christakos' SEAL team personnel were holding both the control center and the main access into the hangar bay. Battle dress utilities used by the Nazis were equipped to be converted into chemical, biological, radiological warfare protection suits once a hooded mask, gloves, and overboots were added. And the SEALs, as well as Natalia, Emma, and Annie Rubinstein, were so outfitted. It was only a matter of time before the Nazis would employ gas, of course, and the commando team was already using it. Nerve agents were not held in the Allied inventory on moral grounds, but knockout gases of various types, as well as chemical irritants and smoke, were available. Despite the protection of her suit and her hooded mask, Annie Rubinstein felt strange, moving about in clouds of gas and smoke. While the 12 members of the SEAL unit held, she planted explosive charges on the aircraft in the takeoff and landing bay. These, coupled with the heavier explosives wired into the gunship in which they had arrived, would not only destroy the entire hangar area, but damage the next bay door and, with any luck, destroy the complex's entire electrical system. The gas and smoke situation was one-sided. Although the Nazis would eventually employ it, unless the enemy was able to rig blowers, it would do no good. The takeoff and landing bay door opened to the north wind across the Himalayas. All of the gas and smoke utilized was being blown toward the rear of the takeoff and landing bay and into the access area surrounding it. Only these rearmost sections of the bay itself affected. Annie glanced at the Nazi wristwatch worn over the wrist of her left protective gauntlet, and she set the timer on the latest explosive package. Unless radio detonated sooner, the charge would go in 10 minutes, leaving about 9 minutes or a little more than that for them to get airborne, leaving 8 minutes or so for her husband, her brother, and James Darkwood to get back with the clone.
Damn!
She started for the next nearest aircraft, taking out her last charge and stripping away the self-adhesive back. It was the most grisly act Paul Rubinstein had ever been forced to commit, but he did it. Wearing goggles and gloves and using an electronically operated surgical saw, he cut off the right hand of the dead clone of Dietrich Zimmer. Wrapping the bloody stump in plastic or something like it, he pulled off the goggles, then set down the hand to remove the gloves. Martin Zimmer stood speechless in front of the laboratory technicians.
Luckily, it wasn't your handprint we needed. Come with me. James, get the knockout gas ready for our friends here as soon as we're on our way.
Right. I want everyone to move into the office there on your left. Slowly, hands still raised. Any false moves, and I will shoot. Understood? Move then.
Paul Rubinstein stopped at the vault door, the severed hand of Dietrich Zimmer's clone in his right hand, Natalia's pistol in his left hand, the pistol aimed at Martin Zimmer. He set the hand against the panel, pushing the stiffening fingers into position. When he looked beyond the doorway, he understood the concept of hell. The explosive charge he had set aboard the monorail gondola exploded. Bodies and parts of bodies, some of them aflame, tumbling out of the granite sky, which was the interior of the takeoff and landing bay. Michael Rourke had found what he hoped was an access door into the next bay, and the fact that a dozen Nazi commandos were huddled near it in protective CBR clothing only seemed to confirm his supposition. A dozen men, all heavily armed. He had energy rifles, and he had his two Beretta pistols. He knew what his father would have done with a dozen men blocking his path, and Michael Rourke smiled. He picked his way across the rail track separating the main portion of the landing bay from the access doorway and the 12 men. The men had turned around briefly, glancing toward the origin of the explosion above. If there had not been panic in the takeoff and landing bay from all the activity in the bay next door before the explosion, there was now. Men ran everywhere. Emergency equipment converged on the area of the burning wreckage. Several aircraft were in flames, the debris having set them afire. In another few seconds, two of his three remaining explosive charges would detonate, taking a synth fuel storage area up, hopefully without consuming the entire bay and killing him. Near the access doorway, there was what appeared to be a massive electrical junction box. If he could blow that with his last charge, he might prevent any pursuit at all, sabotaging the means of opening the takeoff and landing doors. Because unless someone else had found the means by which to sabotage the doors, nothing had been done to them. He couldn't reach the door here, and he had not been in the third takeoff and landing bay. As Michael Rourke neared the access door, he let both rifles fall to his sides on their slings. Taking his pistols in his hands, safeties off, the hammers drawn back to avoid wasting the time necessary for the longer, heavier double-action pull on the first shots. About 15 feet from the 12 men, Michael Rourke stopped. He said nothing. No other sound but the echo from the original explosion, and the sounds of the smaller explosions, now coming in rapid succession, could have been heard. The men turned toward him, almost as one. Michael Rourke smiled.
At last, I have the knack.
White as ghosts, because the sun never touched them, eyelids shut, the specters of himself and his wife and his brother-in-law and Sarah Rourke and John and Wolfgang Mann and even of Dietrich Zimmer and Martin Zimmer were suspended in what looked like spider webs, hung like meat ready to be devoured, each inside a cryogenic chamber of evidently advanced design, swirling clouds of bluish-white gas surrounding them. Indeed, some of the clones were only partially whole, missing limbs, one of them, a clone of Dietrich Zimmer himself, missing an eye. This was an organ bank, a place where replica human beings were kept in cryogenic sleep, their minds blank slates upon which Dietrich Zimmer could write at will, and whatever he wished. With the walking, breathing, already sentient clone of Martin Zimmer beside him, Paul Rubinstein stopped before one of the chambers. It was marked John Thomas Rourke, number 11. And within it was an exact duplicate of John Rourke at his present age, every detail. The graying hair at his temples and the sideburns, the graying hair on his chest, everything perfect.
You are devils. Well, your progenitors are, I suppose. Help me get him out of here.
Never reach Landing Bay One alive, Jew.
We had a variety of possible plans in mind before we came here. Each of us is carrying sound and light grenades. Each of us is carrying knockout gas. Each of us has a gas mask. We're heavily armed. We have explosives. But aside from the CBR gear as a precaution, I think all we'll need is you. You see, I know who you are, or what you are. But the SS personnel between us and Landing Bay One, as you call it, don't do that.
I don't know what you're...
Paul Rubinstein put the gun to Martin Zimmer's head again.
Get the picture?
Then he stepped back, and Martin Zimmer's clone began to open the cryogenic chamber. Paul had promised himself that he would destroy everyone here, and he would, but he would not sleep quite the same again. Because as his eyes moved over the bodies waiting here in stasis for Dietrich Zimmer's whims, his eyes rested on a clone of his wife, Annie. Just as beautiful, with just as much potential to be warm and brilliant and funny and wonderful and loving and inspirational. And he was going to kill her. While Martin Zimmer worked with the cryogenic chamber holding John Rourke number 11, Paul Rubenstein peeled away the self-adhesive backing for the first of the explosive charges he would use. John Rourke number 11 was barely conscious, and Martin Zimmer's clone supported him on one side, Paul Rubenstein pulling the clone's right arm across his shoulders to support him from the other side. The timers were set for the explosions to start in under 90 seconds. When they reached the doorway, Paul Rubenstein did not look back. He could not. They walked through the doorway.
Close the door behind us. Think of it this way. You'll be the only clone Dr. Zimmer will have left. You'll be important.
He waved Martin Zimmer's clone across the laboratory, James Darkwood lobbing the gas grenade into the office enclosure the moment his and Paul's eyes met.
Let's go!
You got Martin Zimmer's clone here. He's our shield.
At least Paul Rubenstein hoped so. Natalia Anastasia Temerovna fired over the barricade toward the Nazi position, energy machine gun fire from that position getting increasingly heavy. The Nazis were massing for an attack, she realized, and in a matter of 2 minutes, if she and all the rest of the assault force were not in their aircraft, ready to go airborne, they would never clear the takeoff and landing bay before the explosion started. There was enough aircraft-grade synth fuel here to incinerate them, and there was still no sign of Michael. Her stomach cramped with the thought, and her palms sweated within her gloves. She loved Michael like she had loved no other man in her life, even his father. If she lost him to death, she herself would crave death, but she would not accept it. She would go on, dead only in her heart and her soul. Beside her, Lieutenant Christakos told her what she already knew.
About 2 minutes, Major T. Emerovna. And if we're not out of here, we're not getting out.
I know that. Order your pilots to fall back. You and I can hold this position for as long as we've got left.
Yes, ma'am. Pilots, fall back to your aircraft. We're getting out of here.
The 8 SEAL team personnel began crawling away behind cover until it was safe for them to make a break for their planes. Where was Michael Rourke? There was an explosion on the near wall between this takeoff and landing bay and the next one over. Massive chunks of granite flying up into the air toward the cavern ceiling, and all electrical power went out. The only light came from emergency battery-operated units placed at intervals along the walls and from the open doorway at the mouth of the takeoff and landing bay. She was about to fire as a figure vaulted over the enemy's barricades, but the shape of the body beneath the uniform and the hooded CBR mask stopped her.
Michael! Michael!
I'm on my way!
And Natalia was suddenly mortified and at once grateful that she wore the CBR mask, because her eyes filled with tears. James Darkwood looked at the watch on his wrist. If they were not in Landing Bay 1 in a little over a minute, they would be done for. And there was no electricity, and the monorail line wasn't running because there was no power. Paul Rubenstein still carried the clone of Dr. Rourke. The only light was from their small flashlights, the rest of the corridor near the monorail station in total darkness. James Darkwood pointed one of the suppressor-fitted pistols he carried into the face of Martin Zimmer's clone.
So how do we get out of here to Landing Bay 1? Or do you prefer to die? If we're not there rather quickly, die is exactly what you'll do.
I'm just a clone.
You know everything the original knows.
There's a way. I just thought of it.
Paul Rubenstein's right shoulder was alternately numb and throbbing, depending on how he moved. But he could not have changed the position of John Rourke number 11 if he'd tried. The metal-rung ladder down which they climbed through a tube about the diameter of a 20th-century manhole cover would not have allowed it, nor did the time. Paul was ticking off the seconds. Even at a dead run, they would not reach Landing Bay 1 in time. Martin Zimmer's clone had told them, as they started down the tube, that this was a waste disposal chamber below them, designed to accommodate water and synth fuel runoff from the landing bays. There were gratings built into the landing bay floors at regular intervals. Once they were beneath one of the ones with a ladder access, all they had to do was climb up and they would be in Landing Bay 1. If Martin Zimmer's clone lied, Paul had already decided he would kill the man himself. Emma Shaw sat in the cockpit of her aircraft, counting the seconds remaining. She had always resented the term cockpit, but there were more important things on her mind. She spoke into her radio on the ship-to-ship frequency as she watched the timepiece a second hand sweep to the 12th position. Emma glanced over her right shoulder, seeing Lieutenant Christakos firing a signal flare, calling off the SEALs who were holding the control center, signaling that they should evacuate to their assigned aircraft.
This is evac leader to all evac personnel. At your assigned time, commence takeoff. My aircraft will not, I repeat, will not be taking off. Out.
I'm not leaving either. I'm waiting for Paul.
I tried talking my pilot out of it and the other one, but... hell. Over.
We can't get everybody killed. You and your pilot stay then. I can fit two more in the co-pilot seat, and so can you. Evac 3, do you copy that? Over.
I can stay, Evac Leader.
Negative.
This is Michael. Come in.
Before you say it, Michael, if we don't get out of here, Paul and Annie and myself with that clone, then someone's going to have to do whatever else can be done to save your father's life and take care of your mother. You and Natalia seem like the ones who've been elected. You're flying out of here. I command this end of the operation, and you'll damn well do it. Out.
And Michelle looked at her watch. In 75 seconds, if they weren't in the air or the next best thing, none of them would have to worry.
This is Evac Leader to all Evac personnel except Evac 2. Get out of here. We'll meet at the rendezvous. I say again, get out of here. Airborne now. Out.
Aircraft started moving across the runway, the nearest to the open doorway, picking up speed. V-STOL aircraft could get airborne at slower speeds than standard fixed-wing aircraft.
Emma, good luck to you.
And to you.
James Darkwood pushed up just behind Martin Zimmer's clone. The grating opened into the center of Landing Bay 1. He looked at his watch. Even though there were two planes on the runway, and just two, there shouldn't have been any.
Find yourself a place to hide in about the next 30 seconds. This place will be a firebomb in 40.
Zimmer's clone ran for the wall, stopped, stood there, started running in a different direction. There was no time to worry about him. James Darkwood leaned down to help Paul Rubenstein out of the shaft with the clone of John Rourke. Paul struggled to his feet.
Let me take him.
No time.
Paul started to run, his body stooped under the weight of the man he carried. James Darkwood saw Emma Shaw out on the wing stem of her aircraft.
There's no time! Hurry! The other plane, Darkwood!
Right!
He ran toward the second aircraft, Annie Rubenstein waving him on. He looked to his right. Emma Shaw was on the tarmac, helping Paul Rubenstein with the barely conscious clone of John Rourke. He reached the Nazi Eden V-Stall, clambering up toward the cockpit.
We'll have to squeeze together.
No disrespect meant to you or your husband, ma'am.
Darkwood dropped down beside her as she struggled with the safety restraint. It would never make it for both of them. The cockpit cowling was already closing, the aircraft already in motion, engines revving.
Like I said, no disrespect to either you or your husband, ma'am, but the opportunity to share a seat with you is the nicest thing that's happened to me all day.
Emma Shaw throttled out on the V-stall. If she blew the carburation systems for the engines, she and Paul Rubenstein and the clone of John Rourke would be dead. But if she didn't get up speed, they'd be dead anyway.
Hold on to something, Paul!
The other plane was just starting to clear the open doorway into the icy air above the Himalayas. She would not make it in time, unless...
I'm firing! Oh, never mind, hang on!
She flipped the arm switch, and in the next instant, the firing switches for the aft-firing missile racks, hoping that the added thrust would get them out the door and airborne in time. The aircraft was vibrating, shaking so badly she could hardly control it. She looked back through the canopy, across the fuselage, toward the rear of the takeoff and landing bay. A massive fireball was growing, black and orange and yellow, consuming everything in its path, moving faster than her aircraft.
Oh, shit!
Full throttle, she had to risk going airborne before the marker. The nose came up, the wheels off the runway. She retracted landing gear. The fireball was closing on them.
We got a problem here?
Maybe. Tell you in a second.
The fireball belched toward them, and involuntarily she ducked her head as the canopy skimmed on the inches beneath the highest point of the doorframe. She looked back, the fireball totally obscuring the face of the mountain now as she climbed the V-stall into the clouds.
No! No problem, Paul. Why'd you ask?
Paul Rubenstein walked beside the gurney on which the stabilized body of John Rourke No. 11 rested, sedated, about to die. Natalia walked on the other side of the gurney, her eyes shifting from the body to the people surrounding the gurney. They had not spoken about how the clone of John Rourke would die. They were on the medical level now, just clear of the elevators. Emma Shaw walked beside Natalia, Annie beside Paul, Michael behind the gurney nearest to John Rourke No. 11's head. The chief medical officer, a Commander Tierney, had gone on ahead. From what Natalia understood, once the heart was available, the operation would get underway in a matter of minutes. Natalia had her knife to hand. She would cut the femoral artery on the inside of the right thigh of John Rourke No. 11, completely severing it so that some misguided person could not somehow save John Rourke No. 11's life. This was evil. This was murder. She was fully prepared to do the act. She touched her fingertips to the butt of the balisong and the pocket along her jumpsuit's right thigh. She caught Annie's eyes, then Paul's. Paul still had her suppressed Walther PPKS. Was his hand reaching for it under his sweater? The pre-op area lay about 25 yards ahead, the nearest thing to them a vacant intensive care ward, the door open, the beds turned up and empty. Natalia watched John Rourke number 11's chest as it rose and fell. John Rourke was a mind, not a body. The body merely the instrument by which the mind could function. She was not killing anything that was even a part of John Rourke. She started to remove the knife from the pouch on her thigh. There was a blur of motion from her right through the doorway of the vacant intensive care ward. Sarah, some kind of knife in her hands. Paul reached for Sarah.
Mama, no!
Natalia threw her body toward the gurney, trying to protect the heart of John Rourke number 11 with her own body. But the gurney was shoved forward. Michael was reacting.
No, Michael!
Paul and Annie were grabbing her, wrestling her back.
I destroyed the heart!
Annie clutched Sarah to her, half fighting to hold her. Sarah looked over her shoulder, eyes wide, streaming tears.
I had you before eat! Shut up!
She looked down at the body on the gurney. John Rourke number 11 was dead. When Michael had moved the gurney so suddenly, Sarah missed. The knife had impaled the clone through the left eye on an upward angle into the brain. Emma Shaw was already starting to shove the gurney toward the pre-op section, the two uniformed nurses running after her.
Dr. Tierney, we've got the heart!
Survivalist Countdown is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1993, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Directed and adapted by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth and James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other titles in Graphic Audio.
Are you, by chance, Anya Creed?
Who's asking?
My name is Mason Jones. I'm here with an invitation from my employer, John Davenport.
The John Davenport?
You are correct, Miss Creed.
Anya Creed, here you are at last.
Tell me, how familiar are you with Genghis Khan?
Born in Mongolia in 1162, declared himself ruler of the Mongol Empire in 1206 and created an empire four times larger than Alexander the Great's. A man to be reckoned with, in my view.
I'm considering putting together an expedition to find the Khan's lost tomb.
So this book...
That little volume is going to lead us to the treasure of the centuries.
When do we leave?
Just what are you up to, Davenport? What did Anya Cree discover in the text that my people can't?
I've been told that you can provide me with the information about the location of the tomb of Genghis Khan.
You can either tell me what I want to know, or I will continue to kill your people one by one until you do.
I'm sorry, sir, but it doesn't look as though we're going to get any information out of them.
Kill them all.
This is the place we've been looking for. I want you all to spread out and start looking around.
Is that...
the tomb of Genghis Khan? I say we go in and have a look around.
Anya, wait!
Mason!
Anya!
Run!
Don't drop me!
Brace yourself!
Rogue Angel 22, The Spirit Banner, in graphic audio. If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.